always tough to follow Bruce. I entitled my remarks for this afternoon, "Will Conservatives Ever Get on the Environmental Bandwagon?" And as I listened to John's opening remarks, I thought he really raised sort of an interesting twist on that same question, and I'll try to weave his question into my remarks as well. You could turn that question around from "Will conservatives ever get on the environmental bandwagon?" to "Will environmentalists ever get on the conservative bandwagon?" And John is perhaps somewhat more optimistic than I, as you'll see. You may have, if you're a student, devoted reader of commentary, you may have noted in the April issue an article by Peter Huber entitled "Saving the Environment from Environmentalists." In that article, Peter begins with the following statement: "As a political movement, environmentalism was invented by a conservative Republican. He loved wild animals. He particularly loved to shoot them." I at least share the latter for sure. He, of course, was talking about Teddy Roosevelt, and he goes on in this article to discuss the extent to which the environmental movement or conservation has its roots in conservative thought, and I think raises some very fundamentally important issues that conservatives need to take into account in thinking about their role as environmentalists. He also points out, however, that this conservative revolution that began with Teddy Roosevelt, in some sense, was the birth of the very environmental leviathan that many of us lament. Teddy Roosevelt, of course, was the person who helped bring us ultimately one-third of the nation's estate under control of the federal government, 150 million-plus acres ruled by bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. The sort of places where bunnies and trees exist and where most of the people who hug them think about going. Unfortunately, with that has come a rather ominous growth, not just in terms of the romance, as John discussed, but in terms of the sludge as well. And in that process, conservatives, I think, have found themselves basically adrift in the sea of environmentalism without much of a response. Indeed, conservatives really are always on the defensive when it comes to environmental issues. For example, you might think of it this way. If asked, "Why did you beat your wife?" the conservative's response, and this is a sort of similar to "why did you pollute the environment," the conservative's response is either "I didn't," which doesn't sell. We've heard about that with respect to global warming. I suspect most people in this room believe that global warming is a myth. I certainly do. But it doesn't win the debate. We can say there isn't such a thing. We can say that the risks are not as great as we're led to believe, but it doesn't win the environmental debate. Or the other answer might be, "Why did you beat your wife? She deserved it." That is to say, why did you pollute the environment? Because it was worth it. We got more jobs, we got economic growth, and that made it all worth the cost. Once again, the environmental community wins the debate every time by posing the questions in that way. Conservatives have not had a good answer. And of course, with the two answers I've just given, the environmentalists have taken the ball and run. John suggested we're winning. I wish I were as optimistic. For better or for worse, I've gotten to spend the last 3 months at the Hoover Institution. Now, when you're at the Hoover Institution, you can really insulate yourself from liberal thought, that is, modern liberal thought. But you don't need to step very far out of the halls of the Hoover Institution into the more general Stanford campus to immerse yourself right in the middle of it. And so I've gone over to the law school and to the International Policy Studies Department and listened to the likes of Stephen Schneider, Paul Ehrlich, and the many other people who follow them around. They indeed talk a good line about markets. They talk a line that suggests that we need to value ecosystem services all the time, meaning that we need commissions to estimate those values through benefit-cost analysis and tell us how to allocate our resources. They talk about market prices, that is to say, why we need a carbon tax in the case of Stephen Schneider and global warming. The whole notion of markets in some ways has been twisted and really in some ways stolen from us. As Fred likes to say, and even accuses me sometimes of being, this is pure market socialism. It may have all the trimmings, it may sound good, but Fred indeed is right on the mark. This is pure and simple a way of hiding ways of controlling our lives through bigger government. We need, I think, to reestablish the high ground that John talked about as conservatives, as conservative thinkers, as libertarians, as classical liberal thinkers. And we need to do that quickly so that we can take the offensive instead of continually being on the defensive. I can thank Danny, a lawyer, and John, a political scientist, for taking the kinder, gentler path and leaving out the economist jokes. We, as economists, often are introduced with them, and I want to use two that I've heard recently to help suggest how we need to take the higher ground. When an economist is asked, "How's your wife?" of course he responds, "Compared to what?" Economists are continually worried about trade-offs, and that goes back to the many jokes, starting with Harry Truman wanting the one-armed economist, so he wouldn't have to listen on the one hand this, on the other hand that. This notion of trade-offs is fundamental to economic thinking. It's fundamental to conservative thinking. We need to make sure that people understand these trade-offs exist. Unfortunately, this didn't matter much, especially in the early days of the modern environmental movement. Take, for example, passage of the Wilderness Act in 1964. It was a simple task because all the environmentalists said they needed was 20 million acres of land. Lock up 20 million and we will have all the land necessary for preserving the values of wilderness in this country. That act passed without any trouble whatsoever. Today we have 120 million acres in the wilderness system, an area the size of the state of California. Today, as a result, some people think we've gone too far. I don't own a snowmobile, I don't own a motorbike, I do like to backpack. I get to enjoy the fruits of those wilderness areas for free, I might add. And as a result, because I get to enjoy those things and because there are so many of them, some people have said, wait, enough is enough. We in Montana have seen several congressmen and senators put before the Congress wilderness bills, none of which pass. In fact, in one case, it cost a senator his seat. Fact is that people now question whether and how much more wilderness we need. We have an opportunity to make the trade-off point. Or take the Endangered Species Act. Remember the main species we were worried about at the time. It was, in fact, the bald eagle. And the bald eagle is a national symbol brought forward at the right time, got the attention of the American public. And if somebody stood up and said, but what about private property rights? You would have been laughed right out of the room. Because people said, it doesn't matter, fix it, save the bald eagle. And so again, the Endangered Species Act passed. But today, we worry about flies, we worry about fungi, we worry about flowers. Perhaps they're all important, and perhaps some of them matter dearly to some of you in this room. The fact of the matter is, however, trade-offs need to be considered, and people are at least today much more aware of them. When they hear the kind of stories to which Bruce referred about the takings of private property, they get a bit more upset, especially when it comes to taking it for the purpose of saving a fly or a salamander. Or take the Clean Water Act. When we passed the Clean Water Act, we were worried about rivers burning in Cleveland. And thanks to some research by people like Bruce and Fred Smith and people at CEI, we kind of now question just how bad the environment really was, but the symbol was there, and people said, if a river is burning, for heaven's sakes, fix it. And again, command and control rose up with the Clean Water Act without much opposition. People said, get the job done. Today, however, we're worried about taking out particles that can't even be measured. Montana had before it an initiative 2 years ago that before the people that was defeated. And it was defeated, I think, mostly because the people of Montana said, wait a minute, We are trying to establish standards for water quality that scientists know simply can't be measured. So once again, people ask, is it worth it? Are there some trade-offs? This is good stuff for conservatives. We need to take that and run with it. We need to make sure, as some people have already discussed at these meetings, these trade-offs exist, they're real, and they have costs. If we can do that, we can at least, I think, begin to turn the tide. But secondly, and now I turn to my second joke, we need to take another page out of the Economist book. This joke goes as follows. It seems that a United Way person discovered that an economist, Rick Stroop, had a very lucrative consulting firm. And the United Way person went to Rick and said, Rick, our records show that last year you made $500,000 in your consulting firm, yet our records show that you have not given one penny to the United Way. Rick's response was, your records also show that my mother died, that my wife left me with three children, two of them are in college, that my brother's a quadriplegic, that my sister's husband left her and she has five little children. If I don't give any money to them, why should I give any to you? Rick's not quite that bad. The point here is economists are very much focused on self-interest, and we think it indeed does explain a lot of behavior. It's not the only thing that motivates people, as I'm sure we'll discuss some in the next session. But self-interest is there, and we as conservatives understand it, and we understand, I think, how to harness it. We need to make the point that it can be harnessed. I couldn't resist the other morning. I was listening to the morning news, and they had Michael Eisner on, and they were opening the new Disney wildlife park, and the commentator said, "Oh, Mr. Eisner, why did Disney do this?" And I said, "Come on, say it. Say it, because it's profitable." He didn't, of course. That would have been the right answer, in my opinion. We need to understand that our ground does harness self-interest and can be used to harness self-interest in a very productive way. First, take the sort of market socialism approach even. Fred and I and others have had a long debate about just how far we ought to go down this path. But just take a look at these public lands that Teddy Roosevelt set aside. Don Leal has recently, with a colleague, Holly Fretwell, conducted a report card on public lands, and they have some rather interesting data. Let me just give you a couple of pieces. Their data show that between 1994 and 1996, the federal government took in 31 cents on the western federal lands for every dollar it spent. That's your investment at work. States, on the other hand, 12 western states, took in $6.58 for every dollar they spent. The states are doing it better in virtually every single way. The environment is better, they are fiscally prudent, they are managing in truly multiple use ways. If you look at Montana, for example, Don's work has shown that a mile of road on federal lands costs $50,000, on state lands, $5,000. There's a big difference, and there's a good reason for that difference. The reason for the difference is quite simply incentives, or as free market environmentalists put it, incentives matter. At the state level, the funds are generally used to fund public schools. Again, a debate we could engage if we liked. But the bottom line is, because they're used to fund public schools, people in those schools, people whose children are in those schools, care about fiscal responsibility. As a result, it would make good sense for conservatives to at least say, perhaps we deserve some fiscal responsibility in the management of our public lands. Perhaps when we have billions of dollars of assets at stake, we ought to at least manage those to earn a positive rather than a negative rate of return. I was before Congress recently for testimony regarding legislation that now exists to just experiment with charging fees on public lands. I stood in the hearing room where I've been before and listened often and had to tolerate criticisms from Representative Vento from Minnesota. Criticisms because the ideas were far too conservative. and been lucky to have people like Helen Chenoweth defend, a Republican from Idaho, defend those positions. We stood before this hearing talking about using fees on public lands for just recreational purposes. When the testimony was over, as all of them are likely and want to do, they had their say. Vento raised his hand first and immediately began defending the use of fees on public lands for recreation, suggesting that this was a way to make people who use the lands pay for what they got and to increase the amount of money that would be available to take care of those lands. I sort of sat there and I thought, is this the same person? And then Helen Chenoweth spoke up and said, this is the dumbest idea we've ever had come out of this committee. We need immediately to eliminate the notion of charging fees to users on public lands. My constituents simply can't afford it. I turned to the person next to me and said, I think I'm in Alice in Wonderland. This is a perfect opportunity for conservatives to take the high ground with respect to how we manage our public lands. And yet, I don't think we're doing it. But let's go one step farther, because in some sense it's still simply market socialism. Let's take the real next step and talk about giving trees standing. I think we should. I think we have the mechanism. The mechanism to give trees and bunnies standing is private property rights, that which this foundation, which this society is based upon. Private property rights give trees standing. They give trees someone standing between the tree and the people who might want to take it down. Private property rights have been demonstrated to take better care of environmental amenities and natural resources. Bruce's work, John's work, Rick's work, and the others. This information suggests that by utilizing private property rights, we can achieve environmental ends. The award that Ori got this afternoon is recognition of that. Our task as conservatives is to first point out why the current system is broke. That is much easier today than it used to be because it's so obvious just how much it is broke. Our next task is to provide a positive path that harnesses self-interest, that takes self-interest in the direction that I think real conservatives want it to go. Let me conclude by simply saying, it's interesting when you look in the dictionary for the words conservation and conservative, they follow one another. Partly, and certainly rather, because of their Latin root. But it's also symbolic that they're right next to one another. Conservatives should not just be on the environmental bandwagon, they ought to be driving it. Harnessing markets, private property rights, and profits works for all assets. The environment is no exception. Our challenge is to simply harness these forces for the environment. And if we can, we will turn the environment from a liability into an asset. If we do that, as a rancher friend likes to put it, if it pays, it stays. And that will be true of the environment. If we do that, as Peter Huber puts it, we may be able to start saving the environment from environmentalists. Thanks.